let me see. That's on the test, and it shows that the batteries should work. There's the volume. Volume's up. I believe we're in business, Megan. I think it's working. When we were talking on the telephone, you were telling me, first of all, that you had come here in 1937. And where were you from?
I lived in Seattle most of my life. Mm-hmm. I was raised in Seattle.
And
went through high school in Seattle.
Mm-hmm. What was your maiden name?
Magdalene Zeiser, Z-E-I-S-E-R.
Oh. And did you meet Jim? Jim Cassidy was a pretty famous man in Alaska.
No, I don't think he was famous. He was known quite extensively. I knew Jim many years before I came up here. We were engaged in this in 1937 in the early spring, and he was going to go back to Nome, where he had a job, and in the spring, and it was decided that when the job was over again in the fall, he was on a dredge. Why, when they closed down the dredge, we'd come out and get married. And instead, in those days, one of the ways to go to Nome, if you wanted to get there before the first boat in June, you would take a boat to Seward and come up the railroad and then fly from here. And with I think one of the pilots was Hans Miro, and this is what he did. But on the way up, he met, I think it was the Volney Richmonds, the seniors, and through them, he got a job with the machine shop here in Fairbanks, and it would be a year-round job. So, and shortly thereafter, he was transferred to the Caterpillar Department of the Northern Commercial Company. So I came up in September 4th and was married to him here.
And then he worked for the Northern Commercial Company then from what, 37?
From 37 until he died in 67. He had just retired 6 months before.
Uh-huh.
November of 66 then, I guess.
And he was the cat shop.
He was the service manager for the Northern Commercial Company.
And you were involved in the work of the Historical Society.
Well, that wasn't until quite a bit later. Probably the last 6 or 7 years of his life, he was very, very much involved in that type of work, and I helped him. We worked together on some things.
When you came to Alaska, how did you come up?
I came up by boat to Seward, I came up by boat to Valdez and bus. And then he met me. He got a car of some kind, I can't remember, and met me at the ferry that went across the Tanana River at Big Delta.
Oh, there was a ferry there.
There was a ferry before the bridge, yes.
Mm-hmm. What kind of a bus was running?
Oh, it was a fair bus for those days.
Mm-hmm. So that would have been, what, about 300 and, a little over 300, no, about a little over 250 miles.
No, I think it's about... Oh, to the river, yes, yeah, something like that, 275 or something like that.
So was that about a day?
Oh, no, we made a stop. I think we stayed overnight at Paxson's. I'm not just sure whether it was Paxson's or... it might have been Black Rapids. Anyway, we ate at Paxson's and Black Rapids, and I always remember the beautiful flowers at those places. And... at that time, they had the Black Rapids Glacier they called it a galloping glacier or something like that, and it was moving, and it had just about stopped moving. They were afraid it would close the river entirely, but it didn't. And, of course, now it has receded a great deal.
Back up.
Not miles, but considerably,
yeah. Well,
quite a distance.
Well, it is, really, a couple miles.
But the thing I remember was the wonderful food at all these places. And where is the... Oh, it's... There also was a place before you get to, there were three or four real wonderful roadhouses along the way, and the food was just outstanding. It was all sort of family style, and but the thing that amazed all of us, this was right about the 1st of September, were the beautiful, colorful flowers. They had sweet peas. They had, especially, I had never seen this schizanthus. Butterfly flower, and so many of those, and other flowers that were so colorful. And you go down there now, and you never see a flower. You can go all over Alaska, as far as I can see, and you don't find anything but just a bunch of gravel out and weeds out in front of any roadhouse. And this is what amazes me, that people can't even have a flower box out. They're talking about...
When you talk to the people who were running the roadhouses at that time, when you talk to them about their... did you talk to them about the gardens? Did they say anything about them?
Oh, yes. Everybody was amazed at the beautiful flowers.
What did the people who owned the roadhouses at that time say? I was just wondering, what makes a difference in attitude? Why is it? What were they... What did they feel then that people do not feel now?
I think it was the feeling that you're a long ways from any place, and we have to make our beauty where we can and have beauty when we want it. You know, it's got to be up to us to have it if we want it. And now they'll say, "Well, I'll run outside and look at it. Maybe that's out to the other states. Maybe I don't know what the attitude is. I know that there are very few people that run roadhouses that ever make any money."
Today
or at any time.
Or at any time,
yes.
And that is true.
And I think that that's possibly it. And they expect the liquor to do it all nowadays.
Yes, at that time there was a feeling of it was their home. Uh-huh. Now it's a commercial thing, it's a business. It's running a hotel, but without the personal feeling, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. I think so. Mm-hmm.
When you came in 1937 from Valdez, you would have taken that trail. It was called the Goat Trail.
Yes, yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. You know, really, I've been over that road in the 50s one time. We went from Anchorage over to Valdez on just a pleasure trip, but the bridge had the abutments to the bridge had washed out, so they put the goat trail back into use.
Oh, did you?
And yes, and there was a car. He had just come off the boat. Some tourists had come off the ship. This was, I think, about 52 or 3. Mm. And... 51 maybe. Anyway, this couple, and Magdalene, they were senior citizens, you know, really quite senior. And it was at what would now be called an antique car. It was a large touring car, like a Packard or something. He brought his car up on the ship. They were a retired couple, and I've always wondered about their story, who they were, because they had this touring car, and when we were going around this high cliff-hanging road,
were you in a bus, or were you?
No, I was with my parents in a sedan. Just an ordinary. We had a 51 Chevrolet. It was a new Chevrolet at that time, so it had to be 51. It was new that year. But anyhow, he got out with it. He had not a top hat. He was dressed actually in knickers and long socks.
Oh, gee.
And he had a walking stick, and he got out and he walked ahead, and he put his stick down in the creek where we had to ford a creek. You know, to test it for depth, because there were no bridges, and these streams ran down across the road. But how was it? That's how it was when I went over it.
Well, I don't remember too much about it. I just know that I was scared in a number of places. When we came, we went down and picked up a car in 48 at Valdez. It came up on the boat, but by that time, as I recall, there had been a new road.
Through the canyon.
Yes. But in 37, I can't remember much about it. But what I do remember is somewhere is around where the Glen Highway, isn't it?
Yes,
somewhere's down there, a little closer to Copper Center, perhaps. There was a big sign that said "Future Road to Valdez," and it was tacked on a tree, and it was just solid forest all the way to Valdez. And we laughed and said, "So this is where the road will go to Valdez sometime." And of course, in those days, there was no road, just the Richardson Highway. And there also was a little road that went into Nabesna.
Oh, well, now you came into Valdez and up over the Richardson Highway.
Yes.
I wonder if this was the road to Anchorage, future road to Anchorage.
Yes. Oh, that's what I meant. Did I say the future road to Valdez?
Yes.
Oh, no.
You mean the future road to Anchorage.
Yeah, the future road to Anchorage, and there was just nothing but the solid forest.
I see. That's where the Glen Highway would have crossed.
Yeah, somewhere in there started, the start of the future.
Oh, that's interesting.
Uh-huh. That was way back in 37. I think. And, well, I had been down to Valdez more times than that, but I can't quite remember. I also came to Valdez once. I went out by train from Seward in 40 and came back by Valdez.
Oh, did you?
And I guess we took the old road, as I recall.
My
husband met me there in Valdez.
I see. Well, that Thompson Pass was a terrific experience to go over in the winter, I guess.
Uh-huh. I came back in September, I think, something like that.
Well, then you were here during World War II.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I don't remember much about it. I know many, many people left. The women left. Many men. Oh, yes. All of the military women had to leave. And many, many of the women, the townswomen, left with their families. But I was pregnant when with my first child in 41 when the war was declared, and he was born May 31st of 42. And I didn't want to go out, and my husband didn't want me to go out, so I stayed. And then I had another baby in 44, my daughter. And so I kind of had babies during the war and didn't work, and things just sort of went by. But I recall very clearly that this was where the Russians came to pick up all their fighter planes. And they came in bunches. They lived what is in the house that is now next to the mortuary, the big house. It was Effie House. They rented it from the Effie company,
is that right?
The United States Smelting. And but that's one of the places they lived. But they would bring in, say, 12 or 14 pilots, I guess, and this was sort of their vacation from fighting, you see, the Russians. They'd bring them all
in. This was their rest and recreation.
I guess that's what you call it. And they would bring them into Wainwright, which was at that time Ladd Field, Ladd Air Force Base. And then they'd take off right over my house here, about 13, one right after the other, in 3-minute intervals. But we didn't have any rationing in those days. But it didn't make any difference because maybe we had enough sugar, but there were a lot of other things we didn't have. We couldn't get fresh things too often, you know. And the clerks at the Northern Commercial Company had a grocery department then, and the clerks were real good. They would phone somebody and tell them that there were bananas in or something like that. And believe me, we were on the phone. We could order by phone or something in those days, and they had delivery. And or we would go down so fast, and they'd say, "There's outing flannel in town today." Well, the reason we had to do this was because the Russians, all of these pilots came in with lots of money, and they were short of shoes, they were short of jewelry, they were short of watches, they were short of yardage goods, and anything. They just bought up the town. So us townspeople had to sort of help each other out, and when they knew somebody was, new stock of yardage goods came in, or new shoes came in, kids' shoes, you know, mm-hmm. Well, we would rush down and try to get them before the Russians came in and cleaned us out.
I see.
Most of the stores had interpreters, Russian interpreters, working there so that they could help these pilots. And, of course, they were they were in the war with us on our side, and so we helped them with what we could. And I'd see them going always up and down the street in long overcoats almost to their ankles.
What an interesting sight they must have been.
Couldn't understand what they said, but that's about the only part of the war that affected us here.
Hmm.
Of course, at the very beginning, why, everybody was issued a gun, and we stood guard, my husband stood guard at the municipal utilities building and everything to see that it wasn't blown up, and we had a lot of local.
There was concern.
Oh, there was concern, and what did you call that? Local manpower, that the Army?
National Guard.
National Guard, I guess, or something like that, see?
That's right. Governor Binning immediately started to organize a National Guard.
Mm-hmm.
You've been down in bed with the flu, and here I come with my machine.
Yes, to catch the flu from me, too. I hope not. I hope I don't give it to whoever's listening to that tape. But I don't know, you think of things like that later on, but at the time we were all concerned. I remember that sometime during the early part of the war, we had a bad fire, and what is now the parking lot for the NC Company was the a big their automobile department, and it burnt up, and in with it was the all of the telephone exchange. So we had no telephone, and we were out of lights for a long time. And when the war is on, and it's the middle of the winter, and it's about 45 degrees below zero, and you've got a baby coming, and you've got a little tiny one, I can assure you that everyone was concerned. And then when they bombed ADAC.
Yes, out in the chain.
Yeah, on the chain, we were even more concerned. And not having a phone, it just... When you've been used to a telephone, you just don't know how much it means, especially in a war, not to have that.
Well, in a war and in an area where you are as isolated as Fairbanks must have been. Mm-hmm. What about the riverboats? Were they running still in those days, in the late 30s?
Not up here. The river was too shallow up here. And there were a few that came up, just small riverboats, but the big ones never came up.
So that really wasn't considered any form of transportation?
No, but we did have some airplanes, you know. We had airplane transportation, but I guess we were going out by airplane from here. Sure, if we had Land Air Force Base here, we must have been able to get out. And
it was a slow run. In 51, my mother and I flew out from Anchorage, but... that was fairly new then, to go to the States by airplane.
I went in 48. My father died. And, 46. Isn't that awful that I can't remember that? 46, I guess. And I flew out. And I know that I came back by, non-scheduled. And I came back for about one-fourth of what it cost me to go out with the two small children. But, I know that that was a long trip, and we sat in bucket seats. But even so, I found it they were both very cross and airsick when we went out PAA. And, I was completely exhausted by the time I got out. It was a full day's trip. And the other way was longer yet. But they just had a pile of blankets, and we just threw the kids down on them, laid them down on the blankets, and they slept through the whole trip. And so I was...
was an easier trip.
It was a lot easier trip. But this reminds me of a time that I went to Bethel. This was during or shortly after the war. It must have been right after the war, maybe around 48, I guess. Every year my husband had to go down to Bethel to check over their light plant and for the Northern Commercial Company, give it their annual checkup. And he always wished that I could go with him, and of course I always wanted to go. And so Frank Barr, who ran the airplane, he had an airplane route down the Kuskokwim to Bethel. And I think he made it once a week and had freight and mail. Maybe he made it oftener, twice a week. But anyway, my husband always went with him. And he was desperate for someone to work on one of his planes. And so he and my husband Jim made an agreement that... Jim would work out my fare so that when he had to go back in April, I could go with him. Well, the fare was $150, and in those days they made about a dollar and a half an hour, so you can see how many hours he had to put in. And he finally got all the hours in, and just about the time when we had located a babysitter and it was time to go, the light plant burned up down in Bethel. So it got to be... just about breakup time, and Frank Barr says, you better use that ticket up because there'll be a time in there when I wouldn't be able to go till he could get on wheels again. So I went, and his wife went, and their little girl, I think. And
Jim didn't have to go. There was no more light plant, so you went for fun.
I went for fun all by myself, you know. But the thing was that he just set up two seats. I think this was a Pilgrim or something. I don't know what kind of a plane it was. He sat away up all by himself in the compartment. He went in from the outside, as I recall, into this compartment. And he flew it alone. I don't think there was any co-pilot. And he set up two seats, one for his wife and child and one for me in an empty seat there. And the entire rest of the plane was cargo. You could only see out of this little window on one side. So you see how much I was seeing at first. So we got to, I think we made a stop at Minchumina, but the first real stop was McGrath. And they unloaded a lot of cargo. And there was a young kid there that unloaded cargo for him and so forth. And then we started loading on people, and there was no place for the people to sit. And I don't remember any seat belts in those days, if we had them. And so as they unloaded, we made... either 11 or 13 stops going down the Kuskokwim until we got to Bethel. We made some on fields and some on, but mostly on the ice in front of these little villages, Aniak and Stony Creek and I don't know what all the places were. But somewhere along the line, and I was getting kind of airsick, coming up and going down all the time. And somewhere along the line, I had gotten out of my seat. I think it was to give someone with, so three could sit there. And I sat with my back towards the pilot.
Turned around.
And I was facing. And there were only these two seats out yet. And everybody was sitting on butter, kegs of butter. That's the way they used to buy their butter, in kegs. And on their suitcases. And any place they could find a place to sit. And anyway, they let
me... You mean the sign, the big flashing sign, fasten your seatbelt, wasn't working?
There was no...
Isn't that a story?
And then they took on two little girls that looked as if they were twins, and their grandmother came with them on the plane. I don't remember where they got on, but I took this one little girl on my lap. They looked like they're about 5 years old, and apparently they had had a little farewell party, because they weren't on very long before one of them upchucked all her Kool-Aid all over me, and that was, I was sick to begin with, and so the rest of the trip, I just had an awful time keeping from upchucking in front of someone else. All the while I was in Bethel overnight, I was sick. Anyway, we finally got to Bethel. It was an exciting trip. It really was.
Well, now, how long did you stay? That really is...
Just one night. That's all. See, he came right back. But coming back, we put on a fur buyer.
Oh.
And all the way up, we loaded those stinky furs, you know, beaver hides and everything like that. And this fur buyer and I were the chief of the... There were times when we were the only two on, and then again we'd have a... There were more seats then. But he smoked the most terrible cigar during the entire trip. And that made me sick to my stomach again. And I asked him if he'd quit. He looked at me as if I was poison when I asked him. So that was the outcome of that trip.
Your adventure?
And when I think of how long my husband worked for me to have that trip, but still there are some funny memories of it.
Oh, yes. Yes, a trip like that is worth every penny, really.
It is.
It's something you just don't forget. I know years ago I was down in Southeastern, and I did not take a trip. I, you know how it rains down there, and I woke up in the hotel room, and I was scheduled to go on the mail run. It wasn't something you had to make reservations for, but I was just going to make this trip to fund the mail run from Petersburg to Cake and some of the Lady Angoon, some of the villages down there. And I woke up and I heard the drip on the roof, and I thought it had been very foggy the night before, and I thought, oh, it's raining and foggy and I'm just not going to go. And so finally, I didn't get up. And an hour or two later, I did get up and I went out for breakfast, and it was a perfectly clear day.
Uh-huh.
And it was the trees dripping. It had rained in the night and the trees were dripping on the roof. But I've always regretted that was an adventure that would have, you know, when you don't live in an area, especially. I was just passing through, and I would have paid my fare, but I'd met the pilot, and he suggested that I come along on this trip.
Oh, yeah.
But, yes, I think a trip to like that, and of course, the fur buying is something really that doesn't happen anymore. We don't have the traveling fur buyers.
Oh, I don't. Don't we have them anymore?
I don't think like that, really. Uh-huh. Not too much.
Well,
there aren't too many travelers.
We weren't there long enough to... He must have bought on the way down, the only way I could figure it out, because they were all there. The bales were there when we... Mm-hmm. And the pilot didn't just stop long enough to load and unload, and we were right on our way again. So he must have bought this stuff maybe on his way down on another flight and picked them all up on that one. And he was going on to buy elsewhere, I guess. I think we left him off at McGrath, but the furs came on in with
us. And you got rid of your cigar then?
I got rid of my cigar, but not the furs, because they were stayed between the furs and the cigar. It was quite terrible.
Gee, it must have been. Where did you have your babies?
Right here.
Here in the hospital?
St. Joseph's Hospital.
Gosh, that's just an empty building now, and I guess they're going to tear it down.
I guess so. I think of, I had a private room for $8 a day.
Gosh.
With the first one, the second one, I think it went up to $12 a day or something like that. And we had to stay in for 10 days in those days.
Mm-hmm.
That's what everybody did.
That hospital has sure seen a lot of life come and go.
Yeah, I should say.
For a long time like this. Then you were in mining. Jim was in mining.
No, we never were. We never was in mining.
But Jim had an interest in a mine.
No.
I can tell you the name of it. What was the mine you were talking about on the telephone tour?
Oh, the Red Top Mining Company?
The Red Top Mining
Company. Oh, we got a little bit of stock in that, which didn't amount to much. But yes, they started that. Oh, let's see. I don't recall. Cliff Hawkins and someone else who used to mine out at Dome Creek or somewhere like that. They were underground miners by profession, I guess, before they came up here. Maybe, maybe not, I don't know. But anyway, they started this mine, Red Top Mining Company, on a hill through McKinley Park and about 5 miles, no, about 7 or 8 miles beyond to the Quigley ground and above the Quigley ground. You go up a hill about 3 or 4 miles, I guess, up this hill to the top, and there they put their mill up, Red Top Mining Company. And they would have done all right, I think, had they had better, oh, perhaps someone that watched the dollars a little closer and watched a few slippery fingers, maybe, and had not Cliff Hawkins or one of the two already had a lung trouble and had to leave. And anyway, they were shut down because the war came. All mines were shut down during the war, and they have never since opened up. And the corporation is still in operation, and the ground has been leased. And there's exploratory work being going on now, and they have a small mill there, and we're hoping that something will come of it.
So there's a chance it could be reactivated?
Yes, there is a chance. It is being reactivated, but...
Red Mill.
Red Top Mining.
Red Top.
But not that mill. They moved... They're down on the lower ground. They're down on... I don't know which vein, but the Red Top Mining Company has a lot of veins in there. And they did not... That other mine is just too... The other mill is just too antique and rusty and everything. So they started a small mill down below.
So in a way, you and Jim were a little bit interested in the mine.
Oh, yeah, we've been up there. I was up there once for 5 years, for 5 days. And I've been up 3 or 4 other times. Not when they were operating, but just up there to do a little assessment work or something like that.
You would have gone through McKinley Park to get there then. Did you drive in?
Oh, yes.
What kind of game? Have you noticed any change in the game in the last 30 years?
No, because when we went in, I didn't see a great deal of game, but I saw caribou every time I went in. I went in, I think, 4 or 5 times. And I saw moose in the usual places. It's 2 or 3 places where you could almost always see them. And I've seen bear every time I've gone, grizzlies.
But this is something, you know, when I talk to people who were here, say, in the 20s, and before that, they speak of the vast quantities of game that were throughout the Tanana Valley here and also down running through the Alaska Range area. And I just really wonder if it has changed all that much, if they're really... I know that there were herds of caribou here in the Tanana Valley that are not here anymore.
Oh, yes, I'm sure. We used to see, when I first came, we used to see an occasional, or quite a few, in fact, caribou on the hills around Chattanooga. And maybe, yes.
Is that right? That close in? What's
yeah,
that
and even on
that?
The summit. On Clary Summit. But we never shot one. I don't know why. I just remember seeing them.
Sure.
But then we often went to Eagle Summit or somewhere around in there and got our caribou. But it was usually in connection with the job. He'd go on a job and then we'd bring back a caribou or something.
Now, what was Jim's work when you say go on a job with the maintenance in the cat department?
Oh, well, if there was a breakdown, see, all the miners. We had many miners in this area in those days, in 37 to about 41. And they all wanted big equipment. It was new to them, you see. And they had just in the last few years been using heavy cats and things. Otherwise, it had been done by hand. And many of them would call for help, and they would have to send out their mechanics to fix their tractors. And my husband was a Caterpillar mechanic. He was also what we called a service manager, but he was out doing work too. And there was lots of calls, especially up in the Circle area. There were numbers of mines up there working. And it wouldn't be unusual for some one of the mechanics to be up there every day, almost. But that didn't last very long, because they shut down all the mines when the war started. And they bought almost all the equipment from the miners. And when the war was over, the tractors cost two or three times what they did in 37, 38, or 40. And then the miners couldn't afford to buy them.
So did the NC company sell their equipment back to them then?
Well, the NC didn't buy it, the Army. The military bought all of their equipment.
I see.
And they shipped a lot of this. Who was the man you were just talking about? You said he's gone back to his mine in the Circle area.
Heine Karstens.
Heine Karstens. He went up on a boat up the Yukon with a lot of equipment into Canada. And from there it was sent out and used, all this mining equipment that they picked up around. He could tell you about that.
You know, I'd forgotten about that, but he did work on that Alaska Highway.
Did he?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he did heavy equipment work for the Army. Uh-huh. You know, he told me that story, and I still don't have that. I should look it up. Because I didn't use that in the radio series. Something else I was going to ask.
I was very fortunate in that Jim would often take me places. If there was a roadhouse nearby...
Yes.
But he would never take me to a mine to stay there overnight, because that just wouldn't be good business. But quite often, if we were just making a short trip, like what they called, he made a delivery. They'd have new equipment, and he had to get them to sign for it. This was very often his work. It would just be a matter of a few hours that we would be at the mine. And also, when he had to charter a plane to go, I went on a number of those. That's how I happened to have seen quite a bit of Alaska.
Well, that would have been most interesting. You did get around quite a bit there.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What, did you get down the Yukon at all?
No, I did not.
There hasn't been really too much mining along the lower Yukon at all.
Oh, he had been there many times. I don't mean many times, but it isn't always mining. It might be for a boat that needs a repair or something, you know, things like that. Down to Marshall, he used to go down there. There was some mining there, I guess, and Ruby and Long Creek around Ruby, and of course on the Kuskokwim. There was lots of mining up and down the different streams.
Hmm.
I think it's been practically every place in Alaska.
I suppose that's true. Mm-hmm. Where all did you go, Magdalene?
I've been to Dawson a couple times, and Eagle, and we made a trip from Circle to Fort Yukon once on a boat. I never was very comfortable. It was supposed to be a passenger boat, but they were going to take a big drag line, pull it by scow, and we fooled around for about 3 hours, and finally they decided that they wouldn't be able to get it off the beach, and we'd go without it. And we stopped at some island not very far away, maybe an hour out. Remember, we were supposed to leave at 6, and I guess we left about 9, 8 maybe.
Morning or night?
An evening.
Evening time.
And I do it at Fort Yukon. I can't remember the times exactly, but probably around midnight. And we stopped at this island, and then they informed us that they had a leak, and that the pilot was going to walk across the island to a cache of gasoline that he had, so he could pump, and then go on and pump this leak. And apparently what made the boat leak was when they were trying to pull this big drag line and a scow with a drag line on it, that they had warped the boat somehow, so it was leaking. And, we drank coffee and ate donuts and drank coffee and ate donuts, and about an hour later the guy comes back and somebody had raided his cache of gasoline. So we had to go back, and the water kept getting deeper and deeper, and we couldn't go down anymore for the coffee and donuts.
Because of the water, a foot deep.
Yes, and we had a good hour's run, I guess, as I recall, till we got back to Circle, and they had to repair the boat, and it was another few hours. And I always remember that when we finally got to Fort Yukon, it was about 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock in the morning, And we, of course, had been up all night, and there were more passengers than there were comfortable seats, and so you walked around mostly. And it was just a little boat. And we got in this car that was in front of the NC company, because Jim had been there so often that he knew that that little truck belonged to the NC company. It was a pickup, and there apparently was just a key in there. And we rode up to the Evelyn Melville's roadhouse. And I hadn't been there before, and Evelyn came out, and she was, her hair was in braids down, long hair, you know. And, well, she said, we stayed up till 2 o'clock this morning waiting for you folks. And so she starts the fire. I guess she had an electric stove, a little plate or something, and she started the fire. And the next time she came out, she had one half of her hair done up, and the next time she came out, she was all done up, and she had opened a number of cans of fruit and had the coffee out. And I tell you, within an hour, that woman had at least 10 of us all fed and had our special way we wanted to cook our eggs. She had little frying pans, and she'd take two orders at a time, and she'd have those out in just no time at all. And we had hot cakes and fruit and eggs, and I don't know how she did it, but I've never talked to her about that, you know, because she just doesn't live up there anymore. She lives in town here. And I've always just marveled at that, because she wasn't really I think she was a stenographer here before she went up to run that roadhouse. I'm not just sure. Okay.
She's somebody's daughter that I should know.
Who? Well, the Bakers, Forbes Baker's
yes.
daughter.
Uh-huh.
But I always remember that little incident. And when we came back, oh, yes, while we were on the beach waiting and waiting and waiting for this boat to go, a fellow came down the river, the Yukon River, in a full boat type of thing, paddling one side and the other, you know. And so when he came to shore, well, Jim went and pulled him in, and we got to talking to him, and he was an Austrian. And I don't remember the year, but I hadn't heard. This was just when, what do you call it?
Germany?
Well, from Austria. He was from Austria, Germany. From Austria, but Vienna, but... I'm trying to say the word all. What's doing all of our figuring now? These big machines,
computers.
He was a computer expert way back there, and I hadn't even heard of them. And he was brought here from Austria to work at one of the schools in New York State, one of the universities, for the for a section of our government on computers. And so he wanted to go to Fairbanks, and he wanted to see a gold mining. And he had come to Whitehorse all by himself on his vacation. He'd been here pretty near a year. He'd gotten his vacation. That's in New York, you know. And he'd come up here and come down the river by himself. And, of course, we've always been interested in hikers and climbers because we've been in that, done a lot of that. And so Jim said, well, if you're still here, don't get a ride to Fairbanks. When we get back day after tomorrow, well, we'll take you into town. So he was still camped on the beach when we flew in. See, we flew back from Fort Yukon to Circle. And we flew back and then picked up our car and took
him
with us.
Now, if I recall, Circle is upriver from Fort Yukon.
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So you went west down to Fort Yukon
yeah.
and then flew back up.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Downriver, yeah. Mm-hmm. So we flew back, and we took him to a mine, and I can always remember that he was in there feeling, and I wanted to say something to him, but I thought Jim would. In the sluice box, he was sort of feeling the gold, you know, and pretty soon the boss came and said, you might as well be sticking your hand in a cash register as to be sticking your hand in our sluice box. That's what the miners used to say in the old days, you know.
I didn't know that.
You can shoot anybody if they stick their hand in your sluice box. So, I remember that little incident. The
I think that's real interesting. I've never heard that. In all the years I've been around mining, I would never have had my nerve to stick my hand in somebody's sluice box because I know this, but I've never heard it said. I've never heard it spoken.
Uh-huh.
It's just, of course, it would have been. It would have been talked about.
Uh-huh. And, well, the interesting thing about this, when we brought him here, we brought him home, and... he stayed with us a few days, and we heard from him every so often. And then we got a letter from him and said he was married, and he hoped that they could make a trip. And he wanted to come down the Porcupine. And, you know, the...
So
Black River. Well, they come from the Mackenzie River into the Rat or the Black or something, and then down the Porcupine. And so we were, we figured if he got into Fairbanks, we'd hear from him. But we went on vacation down to Homer or something, and we ended up at McKinley Park. And this was the first year that they'd ever had the road across from Paxson's to McKinley. And it was just opened up, and we...
64 or something.
Something like that. And we went across... Well, as a matter of fact, I was tired of... I don't like...
50. 50, that's back in the 50s. 58 or something, yes.
Well, anyway, June and I, my daughter and I, are not good automobile riders, and I wasn't... I didn't want to go on that long 165-mile trip from Paxson's into McKinley. And so we decided to take the train from Wasilla on up. And we stayed at a roadhouse or something at Wasilla. That was an experience. The wallpaper was the old-fashioned kind where they stretched, between the two before they stretched linen or cotton.
Right, yes.
And cheesecloth. And then they papered that.
Yes.
And you could just touch it. And, of course, you knew that somebody on the other side could hear every pin drop in your room.
Oh, you could breathe and they could hear it.
And they told us downstairs when we went up that there would have to leave the door open for the people there to come back and forth, but there would be no one at the desk. And there was a big hallabaloo across the street at the bar. And there was a big work train had pulled in at Wasilla, you know, that worked on the tracks, and everybody was really celebrating. All we could think of was no lock on the door and cheesecloth walls. These are some of the experiences you have, you know.
Sure.
And you have to go down the hall to the bathroom, you know. But we lived through it. But we had to stay in Wasilla. There were better places, but we had no car, because the men just dropped us off at the hotel, and they went out this long distance around by car.
I see.
And so we were to be at McKinley Station, or they were supposed to be there when we got there in the afternoon on the plane, in the train.
A couple of days later.
One day later. And so we had that experience. I never go into Wasilla, but when I think of that, that was really a wild night.
Yes,
the drunks.
I've been through there, but I've never stayed at that old roadhouse. That's a wonderful old place.
Yeah, the drunks went in and out. I mean, they were throwing them out. We could see it. We were right across the street from this, you know. All this excitement and fighting, you know. Yeah. Well, anyway, that's one of our trips into McKinley. We were there a week.
That's interesting. Really, then? You went into the mine then?
I think we went up there. It was closed, you know.
Well, did you meet the people that were supposed to be? I was wondering if by chance you ran into them.
I forgot. I'm going off my story. Oh, we went into Camp Denali.
Yes.
We went up. We were going to have dinner there. And, of course, we know them. Celia and what's her name, Leland. And... while we were sitting there, all of a sudden somebody just started kept looking at us and looking at us and looking at us and laughing. And we looked up, and here was this, Harmuth. I can't think of his name right now, but Harmuth. That's his last name. And, and another woman, a woman sitting with him that was just red as a beet and all mosquito bites and everything else. And here this poor woman had made this trip and never been out of a city, I guess, with him. And this was their...
Honeymoon
trip. And they'd come all the way down the Porcupine.
Oh, everything. My goodness, what a honeymoon. That poor girl.
And to think that
she was a city girl, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
But he had gone, at our recommendation, he wanted to see something of McKinley on the previous trip, so we told him to go down there, and he just loved it.
Mm-hmm.
He loved everybody there.
Well, that's a beautiful experience.
And then, of course, he had to take her there. And then we walked in, and there they were. So funny.
Well, that was nice.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you kind of looped a loop there, completed a circle with that. So you went into the mine then.
Well, we went. We stayed at the little town of Kantishna. There's a tar paper shack there that we used to stay at quite often.
Mm.
We felt we knew a man real well, Bunnell, Frank Bunnell, and he had a mine up the creek a ways. And
do you know his story? I've heard of him. Now, what was his...
I don't know that very many know him. He came... He worked for a Denver Mining Company or something when they put the mill in up there, the Red Top Mill, and he went up to adjust some of the things. And he got kind of interested in the country, and he'd come up every year. He staked some land, and he'd come up every year and spend a couple months there.
Did you know Johnny Boucher?
Yes. But he died shortly after I got to know him. Jim knew him before I did.
My dad met him. When my dad went in there in 49, my dad went in because I think it was the Red Top Mine that had requested a road. Or some road development or something. There were at least a group of mines anyway. My dad was with the Alaska Road Commission in Anchorage.
Oh, I see.
And that was in the 3rd Judicial District, the Anchorage area. And so Dad went up there to see what mining activity there was, to see if the Mount McKinley Road extending on there needed improvement. And
it sure does. Let me tell you, they haven't done anything. You see, the Mount McKinley equipment won't go in there because it's outside the park. And the state won't send equipment in there because it's only a 5-mile road.
Through the park and beyond.
And they have to take their equipment 100 miles.
To get it in there.
Yes. And now it isn't going to be so hard because they have a road to the park. You see, but before that you had to send it up on a train from Cantwell or something.
I see what you mean, sure enough.
I think so. I don't think there was a road from Cantwell in there, you see.
No.
And they never did much. Oh, they've had something in there, and then it washes out, and every year the miners have to get in and fix that road.
Well, somebody a few years ago, or yeah, 3 or 4 years ago, told me that there was something up there, some cabins or something. They wanted me to do a painting in the Kantishna area.
Mm-hmm.
So I drove in as far as Wonder Lake, and the road was washed out, and I couldn't take my sedan on beyond that, so I never did get in there.
You'd never get in anyway, because the road is so bad. I mean, 6 years ago, and somebody told me it's no better. A private car could hardly go in there. And the Camp Denali's got a great big sign out that says A-C-H-T-U-N-G, Achtung, that means watch out in German. And something about verboten.
Danger.
Danger, you know. Don't go on this road. So, but they do anyway. Cars go in there. You just got to see it. And I don't think the miners care much whether anyone goes in because they got trucks that can make it.
Sure. They probably, it's just as well for the mining that they don't go in.
Yeah.
Magdalene, another question I wanted to ask you, and this has to do with homemaking. Through the years that you've lived here, do you think that homemaking is much different than it is in other lower states or elsewhere?
Well, this is the only place I've lived as a homemaker. I never...
Are you a berry picker?
Oh, yes.
What kind of berries do you pick?
Oh, I always pick blueberries and raspberries and currants and lowbush cranberries, high bush.
Then what do you do with them?
Well, I freeze them and make jelly and sometimes can them.
Is there anything you could do besides making jelly with them?
Well, sure, you can can them.
Well, no, I mean...
freeze them.
Yeah, no, but what I mean, I don't mean to preserve them, but when you eat them, I mean, you like... for example, the highbush cranberry. This makes a jelly, but... do you make it into, like, have you developed any special uses for the local?
I don't like highbush cranberries very well, and so I don't make jellies, and I don't make jellies at all anymore because I have the problem of fighting.
the perpetual battle of weight.
Yes, and if I have it around, I eat it. But
that's how you keep your slim figure.
No, I don't have a slim figure. And then, but I do like to freeze them, and I put up some in artificial sweetener last year. Some blueberries, and I prefer pies for anything else.
Oh, I see. This is what you do. And how about the cranberry bread and the searching?
Oh, yes, I make that. And
Jim do any hunting ever?
Always. Oh, we've got fabulous pictures of our whole garage full of 2 or 3 hunters, their entire winter's supply of moose and 2 moose and 3 or 4 caribou all hanging in our garage at one time, along with a few ducks and geese.
This has made the way of life a little bit.
Yeah, different. Very much more so. And you see, before we had freezing freezers, we froze our meat, of course, outside, kept it outside. But in the spring, in March, you had to take care of that. And I canned it all. And I had cans, and I have a canner, and... I did a tremendous amount of canning, and I tried all kinds of systems. I would roast my meat ahead of time and then put it in cans and preserve it, you know, pressure cook it. And I would make meatballs, and I would put it in just raw and pressure it that way. You know, I think of all of them, I like that raw just as much as anything else. You know, just put it in the can and impression of it.
I see.
After doing all that work, you know.
Yeah.
Of course, meatballs are meatballs.
But I think you're right. I think
to roast it and then to can it, after all, it didn't taste that much different.
It's double cooked, for one thing.
Well, it didn't get too cooked, but it didn't make that much difference in the flavor to me, for all the work involved.
Well, now, when you can it raw like that, then you put it in the pressure cooker and can it. When you take it out, how do you cook it after that?
Oh, you just warm it up.
I see. So it really is cooked.
Oh, yes. It's 10 pounds pressure or 15 pounds pressure. I don't know which, for about 50, 60, 80 minutes or
that's
something.
Sure enough. I've never...
I pressure cooked salmon. I mean, I canned salmon this spring. Mm-hmm. This summer, yeah.
I didn't know you had a canner.
Watch
out, here I come. That's a lot of work.
Yeah, it's work, but it's kind of nice to have. You know, salmon is... What did I pay?
Something a can. I think it's gone up to now.
Oh, I've forgotten what I paid. $37 for 20-some... I paid a little over a dollar a pound for it. $1.05, I think, a pound. And I got 24 cans of a pound and a half each.
Well, that's pretty good.
I paid for 37 pounds. So that means that cost me a dollar and a half, that can, but that pound and a half can would cost me $3 or something.
Yes, quite.
I figured I saved about half.
Well, we're paying $2 or $1.75 or $2 for a small, say, a 7.5 ounce can, I think it is now.
Oh.
8 ounce can in the grocery store.
Oh, that's what it is. Uh-huh.
Expensive anyway.
Yeah, well, it's a lot of work though to cut it all up and clean it and scale it. Of course, they were clean when we got them and the head was off. And then I had a lot of meat that I was eating salmon here for days, you know, little extra pieces around this and that. And so it was a good investment at that, I guess, but it was a lot of work.
Is this
where
you get your salmon?
Well, I don't know what his name is. He's a pilot that is married to a native Indian, and she has a fish wheel in Rampart.
Yeah, I know who you are. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I got some of that salmon too, except mine are frozen in the freezer.
Well, I don't have a freezer, see.
I see.
I just have a little compartment.
And
I like to save that for vegetables.
Hi, right, Glenn. I want to ask you another question, because I'm going to be out of tape. Tell me about your two kids. What are their names?
Well, I have my son Jimmy was killed in his own Super Cub. He crashed in 1967.
I didn't know that.
And then my daughter is named, she's married to Kenneth Champlin, and they live in New Mexico.
I see.
And she has two children.
And she's the one that sent you this charming picture, the little flower, the yuccas.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, I go down pretty every winter. And so she has two little children.
So you're a grandmother.
Oh, yeah.
And you've got some real interesting artifacts. You said somebody had given your husband these jade blades that came out of the Kobuk.
Oh, you mean the hammer?
Well, they're big pieces of jade, and I would have called them knives.
Yeah, knives. That's what I meant to say, knives. Not you said blades. I was thinking,
yes.
Yeah, knives. Yeah. Yes, the... well, I can't say his name right now, but...
Were you over there? Did you get over there?
I have been up there, but I went to, he had to make a special chartered plane into, not Kobuk, but the new town that was going to be built there by Kennicott. It's called Bornite.
Oh, yes.
We made a chartered trip to Bornite, and there was room for me, so I got to go to see the new town that was being built. Because my son-in-law, June's husband, had worked there for 2 summers, and as a surveyor and engineer, and I was particularly interested. And we had a lot of the fellows from Bornite here for dinner and off and on, you know. And it was exciting to me because of the fact that we thought Kennicott would go right ahead with all of this because they put in a huge, a big establishment there, you know, a camp, and they put a shaft down. But they got water in the shaft, and they could not fight it. They tried. Well, that's all right. But I think Kennicott's just holding off. My opinion is that if they ever get a rail, they're just going to hold off until there's a railroad in there, and then they'll start in. They'll let the state do it, you know. Let the state put a railroad in, and then they'll get busy. They have tremendous holdings in there. They still have Bear Creek Mining Companies in there doing all the staking. Every year they got tremendous people in there, tremendous amount of stuff. That's a very, very, area around the Kobuk and in there is just mineralized. It's beautiful. Many different kinds. I have a friend, one of my son's friends that came and had dinner with me 2 months ago. He's a geologist for the state. And I think there's two or three geologists for the state and an equal number from the federal government who have a camp at, I forget the name of the town. It's below the Kobuk, below Kobuk, on the Kobuk. And Rick, no, that's not it. Anyway, they're doing more work up in that area because he says it's so beautiful. Oh, it's just, it's got many kinds of very expensive minerals.
Oh, I was just up there one time. Bob was flying out of Kotzebue for the BLM. They were firefighting here a few summers ago.
Uh-huh.
And so one evening, I too was able to go along, and we landed on a gravel bar. He was hauling a load of groceries in, and it was a small load that they were out at. Mm-hmm. So I rode along, and so we landed on the gravel bar, and it was middle evening, and there was still a couple of hours of daylight. It wasn't the summer, in fact.
Sure.
It doesn't get dark. But anyway, for some reason, we had to get back to Kotzebue. We didn't have all night, but we took an hour or so while he fished. And I poked along, and I looked at the rocks, you know. But it was dark enough, I couldn't see. It was overcast.
Mm-hmm.
July or August, 2 summers ago, but whatever.
Well, it can get dark,
yeah,
you know, when it's raining, yes.
I couldn't see the ground clear enough, really, to see the stones like I would have liked to. That was the only time I ever got on the Kobuk, and I've heard about that rich mineral wealth up there.
Mm-hmm.
But, oh, such beautiful country.
Yes, it is.
And that looks like it's about the end of the tape there.
When it starts to wiggle, is that so?
Yeah,
starts?
It's coming off.
Uh-huh.
But, I've enjoyed talking with you. This is, where are we?
I've certainly rambled all over, haven't I?
But you've had a very interesting life here. You've done lots of
Yes, you know, I would never have had such an interesting life, I think, if I had lived anywhere else.
Well, we didn't live in Alaska feel that way, I'm sure.
Because,
we like to do the things we do here.
I think so. Uh-huh.
And I suppose people who live in suburban and city areas, they're happy with what they're doing. We love our adventures in the wilderness. So.
You know, every year we would go camping. And it got to the point where I just sort of dreaded it because it's a job, you know. You start out with everything in one box and you know where it is exactly. And about the third day, why, everything is all mixed up. And there were no camp tables or anything. And we would bring our card table, but that's where I put my groceries out so I could find what I wanted. And then I just got tired of pumping up a gas stove on my knees, you know. And every year I'd say, I'm not going to go camping again this year unless you buy me a trailer. And it come time to go, and of course I'd go. So just a month before my husband died.